History 101. Lecture 17. Revolutions. In the previous lecture, we already witnessed the enormous impact the French Revolution had on what surely may be called the revolution in Saint-Domingue, and on what may, besides independence, be at least called the upheaval in Latin America. It is not too far-fetched to say both of these wouldn't have occurred without the French Revolution. On the other hand, the American Revolution was first an inspiration for the attempted Dutch Revolution of 1786, called the Patriotic Movement, that wanted to displace the welter of more or less oligarchic city governments, together making up the Estates Generals of the Netherlands with an elected National Assembly, a name and much of their symbols they derived from the USA. And in turn, the revolution which next broke out in France borrowed a lot from both the American Revolution, if it was a revolution, and from the Patriots. Indeed, as Robert Palmer argued in a seminal book 50 years ago, that was called The Age of the Atlantic Revolutions, the French Revolution was part and parcel of a group of revolutions. And Palmer still omitted the Latin American independence, because his book ended in 1800. And he also omitted, for reasons I will better not define, Haiti, the other global revolution of the period. For those other revolutions are largely forgotten, yet each is a defining moment in the history of their respective countries, whether that is the Patriotic Movement or the uprising against Austria in 1789 that proclaimed a constitution and the United States of the Netherlands in a country that was so far called the Austrian Netherlands and that was later on to be called Belgium, and it was brutally repressed by Austria. Or again, the 1792 uprising in Poland, on which I have more to say in a moment. Or again, the only attempt to a constitutional revolution in the United Kingdom, the uprising in Ireland. All these events are completely forgotten beyond their own country. And in fact, the uprising in Ireland, quelled by vicious repression, has been virtually erased from memory in English literature. That constantly stresses how loyal everybody in the United Kingdom was to Crown and Parliament, although the rebellion is of course far from forgotten in Ireland. However, and in contrast to these more local events, the French and the Haitian Revolution resonated throughout the world, and that both in a positive and in a negative way. Positive, the one government that throughout supported Bolivar's cause was that of Haiti, and it actually offered him armed support, though Bolivar was afraid that if he accepted support from Haiti, that would cost him any support of Venezuelan planters. And negatively, for example, as a lot of African Americans had fought in the American Revolutionary War, at some moments a third of all troops in the Continental Army was black, there were cautious movements in the 80s in northern states to declare slaves free and prohibit slavery. Connecticut, Rhode Island all did so, and slavery was banned in all territory west of the Appalachians in 1787. Yet the momentum of that movement was brought to a virtual standstill as news from Haiti came filtering into the United States. Again, one reason why, while the other colonies declared themselves independent, Spain's two colonies in the Caribbean, Puerto Rico and Cuba, remained Las Islas Más Leal and remained loyalist throughout, was that the planter elites there feared that if they declared themselves independent, this might set in motion a very similar train of events as in Haiti, first declaring themselves independent and then maybe a slave revolt. Again, If the British sent their entire army out to the Caribbean in the 90s, and thus left Austria and Prussia to fight the war of the First Coalition against Revolutionary France on their own, that was partly because the West Indian lobby in London was clamoring for more colonies to build plantations, and they particularly coveted Dutch Berbice, present Guyana, and Trinidad. Yet it was partly too because they needed to reinforce Jamaica and the Leeward Islands, as the French, in their two remaining territories, Guadeloupe and Martinique, had declared the slave free too, and a new Maroon revolt in Jamaica might prove unstoppable. Now, while there is a substantial, but certainly not huge literature on Haiti, it was estimated back in the 1930s that if you started reading all books about Napoleon, you might start as a baby and would not be finished when you were 70. 80 years on, I guess, two persons could spend their entire lifetime reading about Napoleon. There are worse pursuits in life, and they would still not be finished. In fact, I counted at least 5 new biographies appearing last year. Obviously, the reason is that Napoleon appears to virtually every boy, in the West at least, who has ever played with toy soldiers. And there are lots of them, including myself. And though less appealing from the toy soldier aspect, the situation with the French Revolution is comparable. It is constantly being interpreted and reinterpreted in the light of current political events, and the topic of the French Revolution thus never gets worn. For example, the most popular treatment of the revolution in English, Simon Schama's Citizens, is a patent directly post-fall of the Berlin Wall book. It pictures the entire revolution as a kind of collective fit of insanity that had better been avoided altogether, much as the Eastern European regimes afterwards appear to have been the most complicated and costly way of getting from capitalism to capitalism. And David Andres' recent treatment of the terror during the revolution treats the terror as a kind of precedent to the national security state in the USA after the 9/11 attack. Above all, though, what writers think about the French Revolution is pretty much conditioned by what they think about the Russian Revolution. It is partly unavoidable, as the Russian revolutionaries patterned themselves on the French revolutionaries. The French revolutionaries, by contrast, had a much more difficult time with that, as they were doing something quite unprecedented, and they had very little to fall back on, except that is, on some dimly recalled figures from early Roman history, the time of the early Republic. So, pictures of the revolution are always full of all kinds of odd, semi-nude figures that hover somewhere in the picture. These semi-nude figures actually represent ancient republican virtues revived by the revolution, and ancient republican virtues have to be scantily dressed. Yet if the Russian revolutionaries afterwards argued they represented in a way the best of the French Revolution, which was sure to get opponents of the Russian Revolution angry with the French Revolution as well, and even with Napoleon, it is only appropriate to point out that the two revolutions were in many ways completely different, and that the French Revolution addressed issues that were peculiar to the European Ancien Régime, and that often still were in the 19th century, but that are not hot issues anymore nowadays, and that partly, exactly, because of the long-term impact of the French Revolution. For example, the single most important and divisive issue in the French Revolution was who had the right to vote. Under the 1791 Constitution, the French National Assembly made a distinction between active and passive citizens. Active citizens, who were resident in a canton, were not domestic servants, and paid a sum in taxes to the value of 3 days' salaries, might vote, and everybody below that standard was denied the right to vote. By itself, this was revolutionary enough. It was vastly more people than had the right to vote in England at the same time, and it was comparable to the American system. Yet it was still criticized by the most left-wing group of the revolution, the Jacobin Club, who in 1792, for the very first time in history, introduced general male suffrage. Until that was abolished again. Now the right to vote was to remain a hot issue throughout the 19th and early 20th century. But because the general right to vote has become the rule in the 20th century, as far as I know, not a single country uses census suffrage anymore, we tend to overlook how all important that issue was in the revolution. Though, and this is another critical thing to remember about the French Revolution, it was eventually defeated. And thus some issues, first brought up and really already settled by the Revolution, were then to drag on throughout the 19th century, as later regimes tried to reverse the Revolution. For example, the Revolution had completely secularized education in France. All education there was to be run by the state, and no longer by the church. But when the Bourbons came back to the French throne, the church once again wanted to get a grip on education, and that issue was then to drag on until the Third Republic after 1871, which again secularized education. If children wanted to be taught the Bible, that was henceforth deemed private education, and the state would not fund it. Now, the critical difference between the French and the Russian Revolution was that the French Revolution was stated very bluntly, not a social revolution. The Russian Revolution started as a socialist revolution. It was to bring land to the tiller and peace to the world. The French Revolution had no social program. Not only simply since socialism hadn't been invented yet, but also as it was not primarily directed against landlords or wanted state appropriation of estates or of property, let alone that it wanted workers or the state to seize factories. And if it seized property, the French Revolution commonly scrupulously paid indemnities. Typical for the French Revolution was that it punctually paid off the state debt, where the Russian Revolution immediately scrapped the debt altogether. For most of the revolutionary leadership, whether that were the Girondins or the Jacobins, consisted of lawyers who scrupulously respected private property. Indeed, since even the Jacobin Club charged very high fees for entry, the revolution was throughout a bourgeois revolution, of which the leadership throughout came from the bourgeoisie, and in the legislation it emitted, it scrupulously protected private property. The revolution may well be termed a bourgeois revolution, as Marxist historians have been arguing throughout the 20th and the 21st century. And it is something which is still sure to get non-Marxist historians angry. Yet it was a bourgeoisie in the 18th century sense of the term. Somebody who had two hairdressing saloons would in the 18th century be called a bourgeois, and the Jacobins in particular represented what now might be called the lower middle classes, rather than the modern bourgeoisie, while their Girondin opponents would probably nowadays derive from what might be called the upper middle classes, though there was a lot of overlap between them. As to the great merchants or bankers, the real capitalists, they were mostly far too busy keeping their businesses afloat during the rampant inflation of the 90s to be much interested in politics. Or they tried to make money from delivery contracts to the army later on. There was, to be sure, an ultra-radical group in the revolution, the Society of Equals, that wanted far-reaching economic changes and state property of the means of production, led by François-Noël Babeuf. But that radical current was an undercurrent in the revolution. Babeuf was brought under the guillotine in 1797. What the revolution then wanted was not socio-economic equality, as rather equal treatment of subjects by the law, liberté. And that meant, for example, that people could freely move without the 1001 restrictions that were so far imposed by feudal law, in which peasants could not move outside of their village, or journeymen seek another employer without previous consent of their patron. The revolution wanted égalité, and that meant, for example, that some duke was not allowed anymore to thresh any commoner as he liked. And it wanted fraternité, where all people would henceforth see themselves as equals, no matter what their birth was, and in which the society was no longer to be divided between the people with blue blood and the rest of society. Or again, where a clergyman was tried by his own set of laws, not enforceable in any other court. Thus, for example, people during the revolution were henceforth not to address one another with the polite vous, but only with the familial tu. Inadvertently saying vous to somebody could get you in serious trouble in the revolution. Now, this may sound ridiculous, but remember that in the Ancien Régime, if you wanted to address somebody of better birth than you, you would have to resort to a kind of groveling that we would consider utterly repugnant nowadays. Like, I, your lowest of the lowest servant, hereby most humbly beseech you. Furthermore, such humility, such groveling for your hereditary betters, had been drilled into the population for 1,000 years. For, and this is a central thing to remember in any comparative study of revolutions, the thing with revolutions is that most revolutions are a failure, and they are henceforth erased from memory by the ruling class. Yet the memories of these revolutions often linger on amongst the subaltern classes. Throughout the 16th and 17th centuries, there had been scores of peasant uprisings in France. All had been bloodily suppressed by the nobility. Hugues Neveu, in a recent book on peasant uprisings in Europe, has a chronological list of peasant uprisings, which show that from the 15th into the 18th century, there was scarcely a year in which there was no peasant uprising. Some of the biggest, such as the gigantic Coquin uprising in 1640, involved entire provinces and hundreds of thousands of people. The word for these humdrum uprisings was jacquerie, a word calling back to the even more gigantic uprising engulfing half of France of 1358. and that meant something like John Commoner. And so too, in the cities, small uprisings had been common throughout the 16th, the 17th, and the 18th centuries, almost always linked to high prices of bread or attempts to sell local stocks of grain to outsiders, and always bloodily suppressed. So if the common people in the French Revolution appear particularly bloodthirsty, that was on the one hand a form of taking revenge on a nobility that had been humiliating them for thousands of years, and a nobility that had starved them for thousands of years. For if all the violence of the Terreur cost some total 40,000 casualties, of which 15,000 died under the guillotine, the famines under Louis XIV's reign had cost at least 300,000 lives. And that was something the revolutionary crowds still very well remembered from what their grandfathers had told them. Nor, probably, had they forgotten Louis XIV's habit of going to dine in public, so that his starving subjects might well see how the king was scorching himself. And on the other hand, the revolutionary crowd took their revenge on a penal system as well, a penal system that had always prescribed horrendous tortures for poor souls, while nobles were tried in their own court, and they commonly escaped unscathed, whatever crime they might have committed. So, and this is another thing that is too often forgotten, we should not approach the revolution from the viewpoint of the present, or for that matter, from the future, as rather from the past. As with the revolution and the subsequent imposition of the Code Napoléon, the law still in use in France nowadays, and modified versions of it are in use in the Netherlands, in Belgium, or in Italy, unequal treatment before the law has more or less lapsed from memory, it is far too often forgotten how very revolutionary equal treatment by the law was, and that it was furthermore far more revolutionary in France than it was in the United States. The United States had admittedly pioneered that principle. In fact, an American citizen, you are still required to lay down any noble title. Yet, and this is an error Hannah Arendt, for example, makes, who argues that the American Revolution was far superior to the French Revolution, as it was so moderate, France and the United States were completely different societies. The United States was a society of prosperous tenant farmers. There were considerable differences in wealth, but anybody in the United States could still reasonably hope to obtain his own farm. Calling for equal treatment by the law was not really that difficult in the United States, as social differences were not so great. France, on the other hand, unlike the USA, was an extremely unequal society, where up to half of all wealth was concentrated in the hands of a few thousand persons, and where half the population had to eke out on minuscule plots of land, as we saw already, and where half the population also always hovered very close to famine, particularly in the years 1786 and 1788, that had featured particularly bad harvests. And in the cities, in 1786, the pay of an employed laborer in Paris, and there was a major problem with unemployment in Paris, did not suffice to afford even the most elementary housing and bread. Yet at the same time, a few hundred nobles were squandering millions on parties, on actresses, or on jewels. All this, to recall, happened only a few streets distant. To decree equality before the law was for the United States not such a big step, but it was for France, as France was vastly more unequal, and that inequality had so far been perpetuated precisely by unequal treatment by the law. Now, while the 1790s, with their rampant inflation, were still a very difficult period for peasants and workers, under Napoleon, the wages for laborers doubled, and there was, up to 1808, virtual full employment. And though Napoleon invited emigre nobles to come back to France, as many did, these emigres seldom or never got confiscated property back, whereas the property of the church had been declared state property and gradually sold off. French society was consequently far more equal in 1800 than it had been in 1789. In the north of France, the clergy in 1789 owned 20% of the land. The nobles owned 22% of the land. The urban bourgeoisie owned 16%, and tenant farmers owned 31%. In 1800, the church owned 0%. The nobility owned 12%. The urban bourgeoisie owned 28%, and the tenant farmers owned 42%. So, if the French masses, and the peasants in particular, were willing to die for their emperor, this was the reason. Not only were they paid much better than they were previously, but they had often obtained, with Napoleon and the Revolution, a piece of land too. Most notably, and critically, after 1800, major famines disappeared from France as a result of the state closely watching the price of bread. Again, though the violence of the American Revolution should not be underrated, the French Revolution was far more violent, since, on the one hand, the social cleavages were so much deeper, and on the other hand, the forces arrayed against the French Revolution were far stronger. For if equality of treatment before the law may today not seem such a big issue. It was a big issue in the 18th century, and the rest of Europe therefore acted furiously, for the entire legal system was everywhere in Europe built on that principle. As one noble observer in contemporary Germany said at the time, "The whole point of justice is permitting nobles to commit injustice." And another one said about law that the main thing to remember about law is that everything that imprints their inferiority on commoners is well done. Yet even more threatening to the rest of Europe was that on 4 August 1789, the revolution had abolished feudalism, that wealth of duties, prohibitions or rights that had accumulated over 1,000 years. And the abolition of feudalism entailed the abolition of serfdom too. What the Enlightenment had not managed to accomplish in 100 years, the revolutionary armies did in a few. By the 1820s, all Western European countries had already abolished or began to abolish serfdom. Belgium did in 1792. The Netherlands did in 1795. And Northern Italy did in 1799. Though, in the Italian South, the landlords managed to delay the abolition of serfdom for decades. Western Germany abolished serfdom in 1808, and Prussia did so in 1810. Significantly, the only countries where serfdom still remained on the law books were France's main opponents, Austria-Hungary and Russia. Serfdom was abolished in Austria only in 1848, and in Russia it was finally only abolished in 1863. And the tragic, forlorn attempt of the Polish Parliament in 1793 to re-enact the French Revolution in Warsaw and to adopt a new constitution patterned on the revolution's droit de l'homme, in which peasants, for example, were for the first time seen as equal citizens of Poland, squashed by the Russian army in the same year, also wanted to decree the abolition of serfdom. As did too the anti-Russian uprising of 1794 under the veteran of the American Revolutionary Wars, Tadeusz Kościuszko, leading an army of peasants, Amtsknechts, an army of apprentices, Amtsspeers, and Jewish cavalry. That uprising too was bloodily squashed, and afterwards Austria, Prussia and Russia now entered on an agreement that Poland hereby ceased to exist and was to be divided between those three. And they agreed that, quote, "In view of the necessity to abolish everything that could ever revive the memory of the existence of the Kingdom of Poland, the name or the designation of the Kingdom of Poland shall remain suppressed as from now on and forever." To return to the French Revolution. Still apart from all that, and it was an awful lot already, the revolution had further decreed that the King of France was henceforth to be named by and to be responsible to the people. Another outrage in an age where people were conceived as humble subjects who were to all to obey their cold-willed monarch. Later on, of course, Napoleon did his best to placate those monarchs by divorcing his beloved Josephine and marrying one of those ugly Habsburg princesses. Yet he was officially still called not Empereur des Français, Emperor of the French, as rather Empereur de par le Français, Emperor by the will of the French people. And this was still likely to make his fellow monarchs and his Habsburg father-in-law, very much in particular, very angry, as the traditional view was that the kings were directly named by God, rather than that they were responsible to their people. And of course, the beheading of Louis XVI in 1792 was an act of international terrorism, and it was sufficient by itself to bring all of Europe down on the revolution. So the revolution had from the outset not only all monarchs of all of Europe arrayed against it, and the clique of wealthy émigré aristocrats besides, who could count on sympathy of all their fellow aristocrats elsewhere, and had large funds to organize resistance against the revolution, but it encountered bitter resistance of the peasants and of many cities, such as Lyon and Toulon too. For with the equal treatment before the law that the revolution had decreed, also came equal duties towards the law and towards the state. Now, as I said before in my treatment of the Taille, taxes in the Ancien Régime were a kind of patchwork where some regions were very heavily taxed and others were not taxed at all. And there was a whole patchwork of institutions too that allowed cities, estates in cities, and so on, to refuse or to avoid paying taxes. The revolution made a sudden end to that entire patchwork that had been evolving, as I said before, in the late Middle Ages. The consequence of all that was that in Lyon or in the Vendée, the peasants or the privileged groups now suddenly found themselves heavily assessed by taxes, much heavier than ever before, and that by a government in Paris that some regions always had resented. Thus, for example, Brittany, even now, is an ultra-royalist and a right-wing province, as in a way it recalls it was an independent state throughout the Middle Ages, and Brittany still resents everything coming from Paris. Similarly, Paris was resented in the south of France too. Yet the revolution had made short work of all ancient provinces in 1790, as it split the whole of France in 54 départements, all of the same size, all henceforth not allowed their historic names anymore, but rather to be named after some geographic feature. That is, by the way, the stuff of nightmare for French students, who have to know all these départements by head. As the government in Paris was thus taken over by a bunch of regicides, entire historic regions rose up against Paris, partly because they resisted those new taxes, partly too as they resisted conscription in the military, and partly too because they resented attempts of the revolution to annihilate provincial identities. People were henceforth, after all, no longer to be Provençal or Breton or Alsacien, but only to be Frenchmen. The most notorious case of all these uprisings was that of the Vendée, that became the scene of an atrocious civil war that lasted up to 1796, and in which the Royalists massacred the revolutionaries, and the revolutionaries famously killed the Royalists by the thousands by what was called noyade, locking people in a boat and then have the boat sink. We have no precise figures, but that this civil war took at least 200,000 victims, perhaps a fourth of the entire population of the Vendée, doesn't seem unlikely. Now, when aside from with all these regional troubles, the revolutionaries became entangled in a war with all of Europe as well, they announced a levée en masse. Mass conscription, in which anybody able to carry a gun was henceforth to be enlisted in the army, and where the former buildings of monasteries were to be used as ammunition factories. In the very long run, and in a world historic context, the levée en masse was one of the two critical contributions the revolution made to the modern world, and in two ways. First of all, before the levée en masse, war had always been something for a rather specialized segment of the population. In the Middle Ages, that consisted of noble knights that led a band of local hooligans. They might nowadays demolish a football stadium instead of stabbing at an opponent. And even in the 18th century, war was still an affair of mercenaries and hirelings, recruited from such disadvantaged minority groups as the Highlanders. In fact, the British army was to remain a mercenary affair right up to World War I, one reason why the Revolutionary Wars had relatively little effect in England. To recall Mansfield Park, that book was written in the middle of a global war of England with France, but you wouldn't note it from the content, except that perhaps some suitable groom for the ladies there has some vague and perhaps vaguely sexually exciting military rank, for this was of course the age of the sexy uniforms. On the continent, though, the Revolutionary Wars, for the very first time, exposed large parts of the male population, in theory roughly every male from 20 to 26, but in reality rather anybody from 15 to 30 to war. In France alone, 2 million men from 1800 to 1812. From the rest of Europe, another 2 million men in the French armies, and at least 2 to 3 million men more were conscripted in the armies opposing Napoleon. Something like that, such a mass mobilization of the entire population, had not been witnessed in Europe since the days of the Punic Wars. Even the 30 Years' War, after all, had only been fought by mercenaries in a corner of the European continent. As all these wars were over, very few people in Russia, in France, in Spain, or even in the countries occupied by Napoleon, such as the Netherlands, for some 12,000 Dutchmen died in Russia in 1812, did not have to mourn family members who had either died in battle or from wounds or might simply have starved to death. Conscription, to be sure, in the 18th century was still a rather random affair. People could still easily flee from or evade to further innovations of the revolution, the police and the secret police, and perhaps one in every four men managed to avoid it. But all this still meant that the kind of state pioneered by the revolutionaries could throw vast reserves of manpower in battle, and with that, neither European monarchies nor, critically, states outside of Europe could feed. For there too, outside of Europe, war was something for mercenaries and for specialists. Napoleon's infamous remark, after he wrote over the carnage at the Battle of Eylau at night, "One night in Paris will replenish all this," was to that extent not too far off the mark, as the new kind of state that treated all citizens equal, but that also expected them to fulfill their duties towards the state, could indeed allow 200,000 or 300,000 people to be killed a year without thinning their ranks. The monarchies, by contrast, at first had only one army. Had they lost that one army, it would take them years and years to raise a new one. This was still the situation at the time of Napoleon's Italian campaign. Yet as they lost war after war to Napoleon, they began to introduce mass conscription as well. In Russia, for example, troops were raised by a quota system. Every province had to deliver a set number of adult men as soldiers. In 1790, that meant one every 500 people. In 1812, it was 8 for 500 people. And general conscription was introduced in Prussia in 1807. Such mass conscription entailed two more things. First, though in the revolutionary and Napoleonic age, when you had a light injury, you were very likely to die from it, for although some advances were made in battlefield surgery during Napoleonic times, it still came down to some random cutting of limbs after giving the patients a lot to drink. It still meant society was now burdened with vast numbers of disabled people. Disabled people for whom the state had to cater in some ways, since they had, after all, fought on the champ d'honneur for the honor of France. Thus, although Les Invalides, where Napoleon is now interred, dates back to Louis XIV's wars, states had now to build military hospitals, such as Les Invalides, and were furthermore to provide military pensions for soldiers who had become badly disabled. In other words, the exigencies of war forced states to provide the beginning of a social security system to cater for veterans of war or provide needy widows of soldiers with a small pension, whereas before that was left to the church or entirely to charity. For a major part of the beggars in Ancien Régime Europe were disabled veterans. Also, the sheer number of casualties in these wars, 2 million Frenchmen on a population of 28 million, even though these casualties were obviously spread over 20 years, were sufficient to make a sizable dent in the French population. Post-1815 France was a society with far more women than men, and the few men available were deeply traumatized. I think this long-term aftermath of the Napoleonic War is instrumental in explaining the big riddle of 19th century France. Namely that while in pre-revolutionary France, the number of children had exploded to an average 4, after the Napoleonic Wars, the number of children dropped to replenishment rate, 2.3. The other critical effect of mass mobilization was that citizen armies are completely unlike mercenary armies. In a professional army, even though you may actually have had little choice what career to follow, if you came from the Highlands, it was staff or enlist. In such an army, soldiers have still chosen that profession. Professional soldiers are therefore willing to put up with the degree of maltreatment of their officers that enlisted citizens are not willing to put up with. 18th century mercenary armies were simply held together by the cane and by the whip. But that was no longer possible for revolutionary armies. We should, of course, not overrate that. Beatings and hangings were common in revolutionary armies too. Yet corporal punishment was still less usual in the revolutionary armies than in those of the monarchies or in the British one. Instead of just beating and blindly obeying orders of some nobleman, revolutionary armies had to be built on motivation. The first slogan of the revolutionary army was that the French people should together rise up against the tyrants. And later on it became the metal worker and the legislator, the man of letters and the manual laborer should all stand shoulder to shoulder against the enemy. And under Napoleon, motivation was built round that magical word, la gloire. Though, admittedly, to the seasoned soldiers of the Napoleonic armies, the men with the moustaches, or the old complainers, the coignards, as they were called, the life of a soldier was a rotten life all the same. Coignard Nicolas Bonnier wrote his brother, for example, "It's a tough life, a soldier." And he complained, "When Napoleon finishes one war, it's just on to another." So that his main pursuit was to find some way to get out of here. And another Coignard wrote, "Misery and suffering, that's all we have to endure. It's a terrible fate being a soldier. Yet one has to accept what God wants." Next to La Gloire, this new army was built on the prospect of promotions as well. At first, the revolutionary armies elected their own officers. That was changed later on. But the French army in the Revolution and under Napoleon indeed became a clear avenue to social ascent, an avenue that had hitherto, as we saw, been barred to commoners. For citizen soldiers to put their life at risk, they had to be promised that the field marshal's baton is in every grenadier's rucksack, as Napoleon said. And though easily dismissed as such, this was no propaganda. Extensive prosopographic research on the origins of the new nobility that was created after 1804, La Noblesse Impériale, and who virtually entirely consisted of soldiers, show that these people were indeed commonly of very humble origins. Marshal Lannes, for example, was the son of a shopkeeper. Marshal Ney was the son of a cooper. Now, when the Bourbons came back in 1815, they could try to give some estates and some lands back to the nobles and to the church. Not too much, of course, lest they had a peasant uprising on their hands. But tampering with the army was, for obvious reasons, dangerous. And the French army, therefore, throughout the 19th and 20th century, retained much of its Napoleonic outlook and much of its Napoleonic views. The Bourbons were unable to reconvert the army back into the aristocratic reserve it had been in the 18th century, and the French army indeed retained, throughout the 19th and indeed the 20th century, the view that the field marshal's baton should be in every grenadier's rucksack, quite unlike the British army, that remained an aristocratic preserve right into the 20th century. Indeed, to an extent, it still is. Or the Russian army, or the Austrian army, not even to speak about the Prussian army, that was even in the Second World War still stuffed with the Junkers. The family of Field Marshal Erich von Manstein, for example, had already fought with Frederick the Great. Yet, however magic la gloire or promotions, neither generals nor soldiers in the revolutionary armies were entirely tempted by it without having some monetary rewards in mind, too. Under Napoleon, his marshals became very, very rich, outclassing any capitalist. Though, admittedly, a few capitalists became rich too by charging creative prices when supplying goods to Napoleon's regime. Massena a bien volé, as Napoleon used to jest about one of his most famous marshals. But then, the only punishment for that was not that Napoleon would occasionally pull a bit at his ear. It was not so bad to steal, provided Massena looted some other country. For, as Napoleon famously addressed the army of Italy, quote, "Soldiers, you are badly dressed and badly furnished. You require many necessities, but our government is not able to supply them. I will now lead you to fertile plains. Their rich cities will be in your power, and there you shall have riches and glory." Glory was nice, but riches were better, not in the least for Napoleon himself, who had become a multimillionaire by 1799. Yet, these phrases already point to the third effect of these mass armies, namely the big problem how to supply them. For we are here in an age just before the invention of the railroad. Railroads made it possible to indefinitely supply very large armies in the field. But Napoleon's supply system was no better or more sophisticated than was Julius Caesar's supply system. In Louis XIV's time, armies used a system of depots, where basically very large stocks of food and munition were stockpiled and then supplied to the army by wagon trains. That meant that the further the army got away from those depots, the more the march of the army slowed down to a crawl. yet revolutionary armies changed all that. Rather than depending on the Poles, they were supposed to live off the fields. This was no longer the kind of random plundering of the 30-year war, as rather a system called requisitioning. This meant that if the French army appeared in front of your city, you had better deliver foodstuffs, money, and all kinds of other things to it, including actually art, that was fetched from all over Europe to stock the French National Museum, the Louvre, that was opened in 1793. Some of that loot has been repatriated later on, but a lot of it is still there. This system of requisitioning allowed revolutionary armies to march and to operate at lightning speed. The armies during those marches were divided into several small armies, which were called divisions. Each had their own general staff, and they would then all converge on one point, the system armies still use. It was a system, too, that worked very well in Italy, in Flanders, or even in Bohemia or Germany. All had rich cities and farmlands. It turned near disaster during the Polish winter campaign of 1806, and it turned a worse disaster in Spain. The French lost some 400,000 men there, of whom three quarters died of disease or simply starved, and in Russia it turned into an even worse disaster. For, as one wit rightly puts it, it is impossible to feed the numbers of men in Russia who are needed to conquer Russia. The whole 1812 war, then, was an utter logistic nightmare, as cities in Russia were thinly spread, and in 1812, the only two big cities that the French managed to capture, Smolensk and Moscow, both burned down, including their supplies. As a side note, the French happily looted the Kremlin, and during their infamous retreat, everything they had carried with them has irretrievably been lost. That is the reason why the Kremlin is actually nowadays a barren place on the inside. The rather obvious effect of all these requisitions was, of course, that the French revolutionary armies were thoroughly hated, even in places where they had initially been greeted as liberators, as in the Netherlands, in northern Italy, and to a lesser extent in the German Rhineland, and double so, obviously, where they were not greeted, as in Spain, in southern Italy, or in Egypt, in all of which places a prolonged, vicious, anti-French guerrilla war ensued on those requisitions. Now David Bell, in a very well-written book, has argued that the Napoleonic Wars were the first total war. Now this term is actually a complete misunderstanding of the common pattern of Napoleonic strategy. Napoleonic strategy was to rapidly force the opponent into a decisive battle, then to take his capital, and then to force him to sign a peace always accompanied by massive indemnities to be paid to the victor. For the guiding principle of Napoleonic warfare was that the war financed the war, and that France would not have to bear the financial burden of it. So that, while the state finances from 1789 to 1799 were always in the red, and that was actually one of the main reasons for Napoleon's, from 1800 to 1814. French finances were constantly in surplus, as the costs of the military were paid by other countries. Now, this is precisely the opposite logic of total war as understood nowadays. Total war nowadays hinges on attrition, the gradual bleeding of the enemy's production capacity by throwing limitless amounts of material and your own money and your own means at your opponent, while avoiding any decisive battle that might cost lots of lives. To kill one opponent during the Vietnam War cost the USA $150,000, not even counting indirect costs in. However, were such calculations possible for the Napoleonic Wars, it would likely have shown France gained money by killing opponents. However, the Guerrilla War in Spain was total war, not only as that war, which Napoleon had patently started for profit to get a foothold on the all-important trade to the Americas, and a grip on its silver in particular, was intended to benefit France, it did in the final instance not only cost France more than it yielded, but it rapidly degenerated into a ghastly war between the French and the entire Spanish population. A war in which no one was spared, classically painted by the cycle of drawings of Francesco de Goya, Disasters of the War, of which the illustration to this episode is one. And the 1812 war came pretty close to total war. So few people survived the ghastly retreat from Moscow as any straggler from the Grand Armée's column was immediately killed by either bands of furious peasants or by roaming Cossacks. Yet, elsewhere, to repeat, the French were greeted as liberators. In the Netherlands, for example, where the population enthusiastically greeted Pichegru's troops in 1794 as they came to liberate them from the yoke of the House of Orange, as it was said at the time. The French were greeted in Milan too, where the population deeply resented the Austrians. And last, but certainly not least, they were enthusiastically greeted in Poland, as the French came there in 1806. And so in 1807, they created a new Polish state, the Duchy of Warsaw, as a reward for the Polish legion under Jan Dabrowski that had bravely fought in the Italian campaign before. And all this is commemorated in the Polish national anthem, which of course says, "Poland has not yet perished as long as we live." March on, Dabrowski, from Italy to Poland, under thy command, let us rejoin the nations. Yet, one of the tragic elements of Polish history, and it is admittedly not short of tragedy, is that these fiery Polish nationalists were used 1808 to cut down the Spanish nationalists, and next they were to be used as shock troopers in the 1812 campaign. Some 30,000 Poles died for the Grand Empire. Yet, while France only lost Belgium, as Napoleon's dream went under in 1815, Poland again disappeared from the map. For one of the features of modern war, pioneered by the Revolution, is that it is always accompanied by a comprehensive propaganda offensive towards the national population as much as against the external enemy's population. Towards the countries overrun by the French army, the French announced they came to liberate them from the oppression of kings and of tyrants. they came to liberate them from the nobility. They came to liberate them from superstitious greed. And the opposing armies at first had very little to put against that. They could merely say they came to restore the Holy Mother Church, or that they came to restore the monarchy. In fact, French king in exile, Louis XVIII, still wrote to Napoleon in 1800 that he was ready to return to France to bring peace to my beloved subjects. And Napoleon might then perhaps become commander-in-chief. And Napoleon merely dryly wrote back, "I have read your letter. You will merely have to walk over 200,000 corpses to achieve that." That kind of propaganda made no impression whatsoever. However, over time, counter-propaganda too got even more refined. By 1813, the Russian army had an entire special propaganda division attached to it. They published broadsheets, anti-Napoleonic songs, and anti-Napoleonic pictures. And towards the French population, over time, France's foes began to stress they had no grudges against the French people, that they would respect the new division of the land, and they would not dispossess people. Their only aim was to rid Europe of a monstrous tyranny that had time and time again disrespected international treaties. Towards the population of France itself, the revolutionary propaganda partly harped on broad social-economic themes. The enemy wanted to introduce feudalism again. It wanted to introduce landed estates, and it wanted to introduce the humiliations of commoners. Above all, though, it dwelt on the sense of la patrie en danger, the fatherland is in danger. And to that extent, it released the forces and the furies of nationalism, the other major world historic contribution of the revolution. For the revolution wanted to rear a sense of common purpose and common destiny amongst all the new citizens of the French nation, who were now all to be ruled by the same law and were all to die for their country, for which the revolution, for example, invented a whole panoply of national celebrations that were ready to replace the old Catholic ones, and of national symbols, such as the cocarde or the revolutionary May tree, and new national martyrs and new national heroes that were all buried from 1792 onwards in the Church of Saint-Geneviève, converted into the national pantheon. Such celebrations of the nation, shorn of any religious content, are another panoply of the modern state that have been adopted by virtually all states, including the USA. It is no coincidence the US anthem dates from the same period, from 1812. Now, it is often argued in the literature on nationalism that with the French Revolution, nationalism suddenly emerged fully grown, like Athena leaped fully grown out of Zeus' skull, where there had not been nationalism before. In fact, this view has become orthodoxy. This is, of course, a reaction to the 19th century view that nations had always existed, or at least remounted to the deepest antiquity. Our ancestors were the Gauls, as was imprinted on generations of French children. Both views are exaggerations. The French nation surely does not go back all the way to Vercingetorix, a view that is, by the way, magnificently lampooned in the Asterix the Gaul cartoons. Yet the French nation did not suddenly emerge in 1789 either. It was rather slowly constructed from the 15th century onward as a result of slow centralizing and equalizing projects that were on the way since the 16th century and that I've reviewed before. By the time of the Fronde already, in the 17th century, most Frenchmen saw themselves as Frenchmen. One reason why the Fronde, which mainly played on local and regional resentments, failed. Yet by 1790, the loyalties of many Frenchmen, and particularly those who might only speak Provençal or Breton, still lay primarily with the church and with their own small pays, their county, and at best they lay with the provinces rather than with their patrie. So the fatherland was indeed still under construction, even in the 19th century. To build a country, you need mass conscription and railways. Yet the revolution was still critical in, as it were, reformulating the vocabulary of nationalism. Whereas before, the loyalty of the people was fostered on the person of the monarch, and the time-hallowed institutions the monarch represented, that, as it were, incorporated France, loyalty now became fostered on an abstraction, the nation, an abstraction that represented the collective will of all people living in it. And as that nation represented the collective will, the nation had to constantly reshape itself as the collective will evolves over time. In fact, it had to, as the revolutionaries shaped and wanted to shape an entirely new constitutional order. A constitutional order that would adequately express the will of the people. Now here lies the second major world historic contribution of the revolution. The idea of the nation as representing the collective will of a people undoubtedly deeply influenced Latin American independence movements later on. Though, I should immediately add to that those movements partly proceeded from local conditions that were completely different from France. The idea of a priest leading a peasant movement aimed at attaining national independence, such as Hidalgo y Costillas, was completely alien to Europe. Yet the opposite way around, because of the Eurocentrism of much of the literature of nationalism, the influence on Latin America on other nationalist movements, or on nationalist revolts in Europe, is greatly underrated, as on the contemporary post-revolutionary uprising in Europe, that increase in 1821. The nation, then, had to constantly reshape itself, for the revolution entirely swept away the typical old regime notion that institutions were good just because they had existed for a very long time. That, too, was an idea that caused general panic in Europe, and it became the target of Burke's celebrated pamphlet, Reflections on the Revolution in France. For, argued Burke, if the nation was at liberty to sweep aside the old institutions at will, would that not lead to a general disintegration of a society that had slowly been glued together over the course of many centuries, and that only adhered together by the force of these ancient institutions? Now, during the revolutionary wars, this idea of the nation as a voluntary association of citizens and representing the collective will of the citizens gradually swept Europe, at least up to the Russian and Ottoman borders. At least, for these ideas germinated amongst Greek-speaking students and the most Greek-speaking merchants in Western Europe too. And in turn, these would deeply influence other movements elsewhere in the Balkans. That was partly because the French model of a national assembly was taken over elsewhere by the adoption of constitutions. It was attempted in Poland, and it was done in Sweden in 1806. That became a constitutional monarchy under Napoleon's marshal Bernadotte, still the ancestor of the present Swedish royal house. Or it was done by the Cisalpine Republic, a French client state in northern Italy. Or in yet another French client state, the Batavian Republic of the Netherlands, that too emitted a constitution, and that named its first directly voted parliament in 1792. But it was too because of the Revolutionary Wars. Those Revolutionary Wars swept away monarchies throughout Europe, or they converted monarchies into a clear travesty of their former selves. We saw that effect already in Spain, where the War of Liberation, though ostensibly conducted the whole time in the name of King Ferdinand, made the king, in fact, subservient to a constitution adopted by a junta in Cadiz. Again, in Germany, the revolution and Napoleon swept away hundreds of small city-states and prince-bishops. They were either joined with expanded duchies and kingdoms, Saxony, Bavaria, or Württemberg, or they were joined into a new Napoleonic concoction, the so-called Kingdom of Westphalia, that Napoleon had more or less invented for his no-good younger brother, Jerome, who was always named King Lustig, from his favorite phrase, Marken wieder lustig, let's have fun tomorrow. In fact, the revolution swept away all the oddball states throughout Europe, oddball states that had become oddities by the 18th century, though they were viable alternatives to the modern state 400 years before. I mentioned Venice, or there was Genoa, that briefly became a Ligurian Republic, and then was annexed by France. There was Switzerland, that became a far more centralized Cisleithanian Republic, for the first time a central government in Basel. Then there were the Papal States, that were declared a Republic of Rome in 1799. Or again, there was Ragusa, that was incorporated into the so-called Illyrian provinces of France, more or less the distant ancestor of present Croatia. The only oddball state that was so remote that nobody noticed was really Andorra. Now, while all such prince-bishops, republics and city-states went back for 800 or 900 years, what came in their place were either random constructions a few years old, or random annexation by another country. In these circumstances, it was completely impossible to stick to a vision of the good subjects being loyal to very ancient institutions, or to a monarch who was anointed by God. What loyalty, for example, if you were a Neapolitan noble, did you owe to your dear new king, Marshal Joachim Murat, whose father was an innkeeper, and who always had the manners of an innkeeper? Was that fellow really sanctioned by God? What took the place of the allegiance to monarchs and to ancient institutions then was a new allegiance to the nation. In Poland, that as its very existence had been prohibited, or that had supposedly never existed, that was a nation in exile. In Italy, the revolution created an entirely new construction, the Cisalpine Republic, on the formerly Austrian territory of Milan, and that Cisalpine Republic was later on converted to a new Kingdom of Italy, ruled by Napoleon. Yet, what was that Kingdom of Italy then to consist of? If Italy was to consist of all Italian-speaking lands, shouldn't it at least include Venice, that was surely a very Italian place, and yet was now randomly attached to Austria? Or shouldn't it include Naples, still a separate kingdom? Again, there was Germany, where the sweeping away of its constituent states, its constituent republics, or its constituent prince bishopdoms, that had once constituted the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, as it was abolished in 1807, left a void. For if Germany was henceforth to be a German nation rather than a holy empire, what was that nation to consist of? For if Germany was to be all German-speaking countries, the big question then became whether that German nation was to be Kleindeutsch, Prussia, and the smaller states, coterminant with German-speaking lands, or whether it was to be Großdeutsch, that is, including Austria. But if Germany was to be Großdeutsch, what was then to become of the non-German-speaking parts of the Habsburg Empire? Should Germany, for example, include Czech-speaking Bohemia? Finally, the long struggle with France strengthened feelings of national bonding in the monarchies as well, in Britain, that is, between Scotland and England. For although there had been a lot of sympathy for the ideals of the French Revolution in Scotland, there was little sympathy for Boney, as the English always called Bonaparte. And at any rate, as one Russian visitor noted in 1800, quote, "To be not an Englishman, or for that matter a Scotsman, and to be an honest man seems to Englishmen an insolvable contradiction. Hence they receive any foreigner coldly, with a look of contempt, and they are clearly determined never to know him." Similarly so, in Russia, where the war also served to further the cause of national bonding, and in particular the War of 1812 did so. The Russians still call this the Patriotic War, actually the Small Patriotic War, as opposed to the Big Patriotic War, which is the Second World War. Now, in that War of 1812, Napoleon probably made a double miscalculation. On the one hand, he calculated that Russian Tsar Alexander I would behave as Austrian or Prussian monarchs had behaved before. Once the capital was taken, they would then offer terms of peace, as these monarchs had always done. For example, Lithuania, where the French armies were generally very well received, as the Russians were far from popular there, might then be ceded to the new Duchy of Warsaw. Or Russia might henceforth bar English ships entrance to its ports. Yet, as Tsar Alexander had at the beginning of the war announced that this was a war to defend the fatherland, for which the entire Russian people was to get into arms, some amiable diplomatic settlement, as the Austrians, the Prussians, or indeed the Russians themselves had previously sought and offered, was out of the question, as long as the enemy of Russia stood on the territory of Russia proper, and that was not bordered by the Niemen, as rather was somewhere east of Lithuania, with some hesitation, I might say the modern White Russian border, there could never be peace. Also, the French had assumed that the Russian army, only held together by the whip, would disintegrate. Now, the Tsar had announced, as Napoleon's Grande Armée crossed the Niemen River, Russian people, brave descendants of courageous Slavs, smash the lions and tigers who want to destroy you. Let anyone unite. With the cross in our hands and the weapons, we shall be invincible. And the clergy had denounced Napoleon as the Antichrist. Yet the French had simply assumed that in a society where Russian-speaking serfs and French or German-speaking landlords often not even shared the same language, such calls would remain unheeded and hollow. And they laughed very much in particular about those primitive paupers. Napoleon's aide-de-camp, the Comte de Secure, wrote that the popes had convinced the people the French were the legions of Satan, and so the French, as they were advancing, thought that all such crude fabrications would soon evaporate. Yet as they were advancing, they met nothing but scorched earth, and the nobles had retreated into the interior with their serfs, sacrificing their riches, their homes, or anything that might be of use to the French. And so, Secure wrote, we were fighting no longer a war between kings, a religious war, a national war, and all at once. And as Moscow then went up in flames, the French desperately asked themselves, what people are these, that they rather burn their own capital than have us take it? While at Borodino, near the gates of Moscow, 40,000 Russian soldiers were killed and only 800 surrendered. This 1812 war was a patriotic war, and it was a Russian patriotism that went all the way back to the 16th century and was strengthened by the dismal experiences of the troubles in the 17th century. It was that patriotism that allowed Russia to win, and that allowed Russia to become the dominant power of Europe and of Central Asia until the German unification in 1871. At the end of a conflict that had cost the Russian Empire at least 500,000 casualties on 12 million people, the modern equivalent in the USA would be 15 million casualties, or the effects of a thermonuclear bomb on New York. The Cossacks could on 30 March 1814 look down on Paris from Montmartre, as they finally beheld the city that, as one Russian witness wrote, had assumed the right to dictate to the world the tastes, the fashions, and enlightenment, where the laws were issued for the nations and the chains were wrought to enslave them, and from where armies marched out to every corner of Europe. In short, that city that had always considered itself capital of the world, and now it had fallen to the Russians. Adding that while the so-called civilized Grande Armée had completely looted Moscow, while the dreaded Russian barbarians rather behaved like a bunch of tourists in Paris, it was an unrivaled victory for Russian arms. And Tsar Alexander was heralded as savior, not merely in Russia, but in Germany, to yet this great victory raised problems and anguishes both in Russia and abroad. For what was this new paramount power of Europe that had taken France's place heading to? Or, as writer Nikolai Gogol put it, quote, "Russia, you are speeding along like a fiery and matchless troika. Russia, where are you flying? Russia, answer me. There is no answer. The bells are tinkling and filling the air with a wonderful pealing. The air is torn and thundering as it turns to wind. Everything on earth comes flying past the Russian troika, and it looks askance at her. Other peoples and states move aside, and they make way. Rent in a thousand shreds, the air roars past you, Russia, as you are overtaking the world, and you shall one day force all nations, all empires, to give way to you." The direction Russia is heading, that became the paramount issue in Europe in the 19th century, is still an undecided issue, and it is yet and still as critical as it was in 1815.